We're going to have three speakers here, as you know, on this program, and they will be in this order: Juliet Kono first, then Naomi Hirahara, and then Joy Kogawa. So 1, 2, 3. Okay. Let me introduce them briefly outside of what you see in the conference program. Juliet Kono is a published author, beginning with her first book in 1988 called Hilo Reigns, which is a collection of poetry about Issei, Nisei, Sansei, and concludes with a poem about Yonsei, plus one story that's in the middle of the book called Oji-chan. She went on from there to publish a number of books, the second book being Tsunami Years. She's a native of Hilo on the island of Hawaii. She was 3 years old when the infamous April Fool's Day 1946 tsunami wiped out Shinmachi of Hilo on Hilo Bay, and her family was inundated by the tsunami. So she's a survivor of that when she was 3 years old. Her recent book is Anshu, Dark Sorrow. And I really recommend that you read this book because it's, to me, one of the most deeply spiritual American accounts of what happened on August 6, 1945 in Hiroshima and its aftermath. So I'll leave it at that. The book will be available for you to look at the Elliott Bay book display. The next reader is Naomi Hirahara. Naomi was born and raised in Southern California and is the Edgar Award-winning author of the Mas Arai mystery series, which features a Japanese-American gardener and atomic bomb survivor who solves crimes. And the books include Summer of the Big Bachi, which was, I believe, the first one that was published, and people, you know, even in the Seattle community paid attention to what a Los Angeles person had written, right? They said, Bachi, Bachi, look, there's a book with the name Bachi, the word Bachi in it. Yeah, that's good. Snakeskin Shamisen, Blood Hina, and now, available again at the Elliott Bay book display, Strawberry Yellow. She's a former editor of Rafu Shimpo, the largest Japanese-American newspaper in the U.S., and she has also released a number of nonfiction books. A number of her short stories have been included in various anthologies, including those published through Top Suspense Group. Our third reader will be Joy Kogawa. Joy is, she made a worldwide impact with her first novel, although it was not her first book. She was a poet by artistry. Through the 1970s and up into the beginning of the 1980s when she published Obasan. Obasan, the Japanese-Canadian, you know, one of the most important Canadian novels ever published concerning the Japanese-Canadian community and what happened to them during World War II in several settings. I'll just kind of leave it at that, and maybe some of you already know what her book is about, and the subsequent books after that, Itsuka, and a number of other books as well. So about the theme that has to do with representations of history in Nikkei literature, we thought of this, that is the JANM organizers of the conference and those of us at University of Washington who are working on the program, we thought of it because of the lively concerns, always interesting concerns about what do you do when you have a community here that's very interested, you hear for the past couple of hours about preserving our history, and yet this history necessarily gets passed on through interpretive works. That is, people are always giving the history some kind of spin, right? Through fiction or through real life, it happens. It has to happen, and that's what gives the stories their life. So what is the relationship between literature and history? I can say then right offhand that here in Juliet we have a writer who, to write Anshu about what happened in World War II in Japan to her main character, had to do an awful lot of research, historical research, not only in the United States but also in Japan. in order to write that book. Then we have Naomi, whose book, offhand, we may say your works are not really historical novels, but yet I can, you know, I don't have to tell you how many times your readers have said, yeah, this is so true to life, true to the experience, or else the opposite, saying that this didn't quite ring true. Ring true to what? Everybody has some sort of sense of what the historical reality was, and they read your book with that question in mind, your book. So you have another way of approaching this. And Joy, with her book, Obasan, and her subsequent books, there was a huge, huge amount of her own intuition about things that was at work. So the history, more or less, informed her imagination of what was being written. And then that imagination, in turn, has influenced how we see the history she's written about. And that includes, of course, the history of what happened on August 9th, 1945 in Nagasaki. So with that, Juliet, would you like to begin?
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Steve, for your kind words and for being such a supporter of my work. I first met Steve when he wrote his seminal book, A View from the Shore, Literary Traditions of Hawaii, which was published in 1991, and we've known each other since then. So it's been a long time, yeah, Steve? So most of my writing focus has been on about the experiences of the Japanese Americans in Hawaii as immigrants, while working for the sugar plantation, as survivors of the tsunami, and their experiences during World War II and beyond. Over the years, I've written about these experiences through my poetry and my short stories. However, my latest book, a novel called Anshu, breaks away from this focus on Hawaii with the bulk of the book in Japan. I'm going to read a few poems which very loosely follow the highlights of my life, and later we'll read an excerpt from my novel. I will begin with a poem that serves as an invocation. It is called Face. A boxcar slammed into Grandfather and sheared off his face. Grandfather lived. There was no reconstructive surgery for this plantation hand and once handsome man. He lost his nose, and the smashed bones of his cheeks sagged and flattened his face. There are no trains making runs from plantations anymore. The closest thing to these trains are the restored ones housed at the Bishop Museum. Recently, I walked among them and roamed the insides of the empty cars. I closed the door to one of them, placed my cheek against the warmth of the rough door's boards, and Grandfather's voice resounded from the cane bulks and backs of bent men, vibrating my facial bones, urging tenderly my own face to form. All of my grandparents came to Hawaii as contract laborers to work in the cane fields. One side came from Kumamoto, the other from Hiroshima. The cane cutters. The brave Hawaiian moon sits in the saddle of morning, bucking its light. A woman shivers as she trudges behind a man. She carries the lunches and an old kerosene lantern that trails fumes heavily into the gloom. Surrounding them, piles of bagasse sit silently fat and rank. The old-looking couple stop to rest. The man takes out two long knives. They sparkle in the careless light. He fingers each honed edge and tenderly caresses the sharpness. Pleased, he hands one to his wife. Together, they work the tall burnt fields long into the tiring hours. They sing and they dream to the pendulum swing of machetes. We then entered the war with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I was born in 1943 during the blackout. I'm what you call a blackout baby. The Japs, my mysterious kin, have just bombed Pearl Harbor. Each night thereafter, each home is allowed one blackened light. Windows are tarred and cracks under doors are stuffed with rags, chastising the light that dares to wander. The block wardens come drawn like termites to light. Violators are startled by the bang on the door, and if you are a Jap, you have to be careful. They could send you to internment camp somewhere in Colorado. One night, a woman labors in the heat of the blackout light. Into this darkness, a child is born. It is I, a blackout baby, nosing in the darkness with heavy eyes, a yellow belly filled with a livid cry. During the war, some of our relatives were interned at Crystal City, Texas. And this is a poem I wrote for one of my mother's aunts. Internment. Corralled, they are herded inland from Santa Rosa. After the long train ride on the Santa Fe, the physical exam, the delousing with DDT, the branding of her indignation, she falls asleep. Days later, she awakens in an unfamiliar barracks, Crystal City, Texas, on land once a pasture. Not wanting to, not meaning to see beauty in this stark landscape, she sees nonetheless through her tears on the double row of barbed wire fencing which holds them in like stolid cattle. Dewdrops, impaled and golden. My family survived the tsunami of 1946. This poem is about a boy picking up fish along the shore when the water receded. Schoolboy from Apmauca. 21 students and teachers at Lapahoehoe School were killed in the tsunami of 1946. I'm talking to this boy. You ran outdoors to look at the receding sea. Open and bare, it was as if the tale of the five Chinese brothers had come true, the story your teacher had read to you. Somewhere on the other side of the ocean, the first Chinese brother had drunk all the water, and here on the peninsula, how everything glittered. Red stars, pink sea urchins, black sea urchins, pink anemones. With pants rolled high, shirt tucked in at the waist, you walked into shallow water and picked up the red, gold, and silver fish. Papio, veke, ave oveo. Fish for a good boy to take home. Fish for supper. Look, look, you yelled to everyone, pointing at your prizes. A sudden roar, as in the story, the first Chinese brother who could no longer hold the water let it rush out into our side of the world. If I could, I'd have stretched my legs into stilts like the third Chinese brother and plucked you from the sea. You dropped the colors from your hands. You moved up to face the wave. And in your wonder, all you could do was gape and point at what curled magnificently above you. This is the last poem I'm going to read, and it's about going haka mairi, or going to the grave sites. It's called Yonsei. I hear the music ride the updraft in this valley. It is not yours. You are thumbing your way to the North Shore, being dropped over at Leftovers or Thompson's Corner first before making your way down, shouldering a radio, smothering the speaker into your ear, the one with the gold star that glints and steals studs of moonlight when your hair whips away from your face. I can see the white swagger of your body as it moves, shadows of firm bones. They hold your body across roads as each lean and tall muscle ripples you forward in your dark good health, each sinew curved, warm as sun. You live so far from what connects you. You have no recollection of old plantation towns, of rains that plummeted like the sheaves of cane, the song of flumes, the stink of rotting feet, the indignities of hard labor. Your blood runs free from the redness of soil, but your zori are caked with mud, your dreams mixed in sun, wild surf, and turbulent air. And yet once a year you come with me in your dark brooding, like a craving, to visit the ancestors' gravesites to pray. You say nothing about being held to these traditions. You pray, bow, and burn incense. You travel backward in time for a brief moment and say dutiful words, do the respectful gestures. And I know that in my longest sleep, you would come and I would not want. Before closing, I'm going to read an excerpt from Anshu, my latest novel. And Hee-chan is the main character, and this is she is sent to Japan because she loves to play with fire, and one of the fires she plays with is passion and desire. So anyway, this is when she is a very young girl. Born of fire, fire my element, Himiko, child of fire, my name. Don't play with fire, Mama said. Do you want to get burned? I loved fire, played with it every chance I could. My parents worried that I might get hurt, burn the house down, or destroy the cane fields that took years to grow, and all that the sugar plantation camp people had worked for would go up in smoke. Worst of all, kill someone, if not myself. And so the story begins, and we fast forward to when she's in Japan. She gives birth to her baby, and they are starving, and they're doing the black market. Hee-chan and her cousins deal with the black market, and her cousins are Iwao, Sa-chan, Norio, Yuki-chan, and her daughter is called Sumie. Ah, okay. This is in 1940, about 1943, during the war. And her cousin, Iwao, is the lookout for all this illicit activity. And his signal is to call like the crow when something is going awry. So, as fuel and foods grew scarcer, more and more economic police roamed the streets. We were small operators with very little money, so we just couldn't risk being caught and having to pay the heavy fines the government would have levied against us. We would be ruined. On one such foray near Asakusa, we heard Iwao signal, "Caw, caw," but it was too late. "Stop right there," an economic police officer said, running toward us. "I want to check your cart." We complied. Jerked to a stop, no one spoke. He looked at me strangely. Hee-chan at this time had beriberi, and so she was sick. Why are you on the cart like this? Are you hiding something? I can't walk well, I said, hoping he would pity me. We have only what belongs to us. That's so. Here, have some candy. Give this to your children, I said. I shoved a handful of sweets into his hands, making sure that they overflowed his cupped palms. As the officer bent over to pick up the candy that had been scattered into the street, Norio said, "Let's go, run!" "Hold up," the officer shouted and blew his whistle, but he didn't chase us right away. Looking back as we ran, I saw he was more concerned about the candy on the ground and ran after us only after having pocketed each piece. "Head toward the Jinja," shouted Norio. "Come on, Sa-chan," Iwao said, running out from his lookout position to help Norio push the cart. I bounced high on it, barely able to maintain my balance while I held on to Sumie and Yuki-chan. "In here," Norio yelled, the milling crowd at the shrine swallowing us whole. "That was fun," Iwao said after we lost the policeman. He grinned and dusted his hands in a good riddance. "No, it wasn't," Sa-chan said, grabbing her side and grimacing. "We're just common thieves. That's what we've become." None of us took Sa-chan seriously, but we had learned our lesson. We moved with extra caution from then on. In the city, people planted vegetable gardens with onions or carrots on every square inch allowed in the parks or on the sides of the streets. we rarely saw rats, cats, dogs, or birds around anymore. Every so often, the boys would trap a dove or starling, and I would boil the bird in a thin soup together with some radishes and wrinkled carrots for a feast. Though we wanted to, we couldn't keep chickens or rabbits because we had no feed. On a rare occasion, Harua Auntie brought home a small chicken. In our first meal, we ate all of the meat and sucked on the bones for their juices. Auntie saved the bones on our plates and boiled them, which we cracked and sucked for their marrow, creating a watery soup mixed with vegetables for the next meal. Reduced to eating stews made out of grass, a mixture of thistle, mugwort, chickweed, almost anything edible found on the ground, we suffered from upset stomachs, frequent cramping, constipation, diarrhea. I stretched rice and beans by adding a little to these stews. After a time, the revolting ingredients of a pudding made of fried wheat flour and rice bran took the place of rice on the ration counters. "I can't stand it anymore. I want rice. I can't eat this horseshit," Noria cried out in disgust, spitting out in a spray the nukapan, the rice substitute we had been eating. "When is this going to stop? Smells like horseshit, tastes like horseshit. Can't the government give us anything better?" And so it goes on and on. Thank you.
I feel like I'm doing stand-up here. It's such an honor to be with this illustrious panel. And I think it's kind of interesting that three of us have written about, like, the atomic bombings in Japan, that, you know, this could be another kind of panel altogether on its global focus. Well, my name is Naomi. I'm Naomi, and I'm not an alcoholic, but I'm a mystery writer. So, the mystery genre, you know, of course that label is just something that the publishers stick on their books so they can sell them. But I think it does tell you a little something about the expectations that readers have when they come to mysteries, as well as it tells you a little bit about the readers that are interested in it as well. Mystery fans are voracious readers. They love to learn about new worlds. They want to solve the crime, so they're very observant. And so it's really wonderful. And once a mystery reader gets her hooks on into a character, she'll want to follow that character to the next book. So that's nice for us authors. It's interesting because I do have a scholar in Japan who's actually studying my works, and she had mentioned something like that I have a journalistic bent in my books. And, you know, what we think of journalists, you know, I'm going, is that an insult? You know, I was trying to figure that all out. But I've come to kind of understand her observation in that I'm interested in kind of like the whole community, not just a singular voice. And usually with my characters, there's something external. You know, usually it's a dead body, but something that pushes my character forward so there's action, but it also reveals something internally, what's going on with my character as well. But, you know, with that said, the mystery genre is notorious in terms of co-opting, appropriating, misappropriating cultures. For instance, there was a real-life detective in Hawaii, and his name was Changapana. He was, I think, a diminutive but very tough guy. And he had a horse whip, and when he was upset, he would crack it. And in the writer's hands, he turned into kind of like this portly Hawaiian detective named Charlie Chan, and who spoke in, like, you know, Confucius say, dot, dot, dot. And he had, you know, boys, sons that would help in solving the crime, too. And also, I am from Los Angeles, and that is like the home of noir fiction. Raymond Chandler, for example, and Sam Spade, and many of these authors of that time, they were like, they wrote about the lone white man kind of solving the crime, and they described America at that time as a very scary place in terms of outsiders, political outsiders, and also outsiders of color. So there was this paranoia that kind of ran through the works of our classic, you know, noir writers. So that's my genre as well. And then in terms of poetic license, in addition to those things, in my case, because I have a Kibe Nise elderly hibakusha, atomic bomb survivor, who's solving crimes that the LAPD and the NYPD cannot. So that is a fantasy, you know, this is a huge fantasy. I know I'm purporting, but I love it. And another fantasy is, you know, probably Moss and his elderly friends in my books will never die, you know, and that's a fantasy I want to continue as well. So I wanted to read to you a couple of excerpts. The first one is from my first book, Summer of the Big Bachi. And this is kind of a microcosm of men, Japanese-American men, or people, men of Japanese ancestry during World War II. This is a contemporary mystery. Essentially what I do is there was a TV show that was like called Cold Case. It was based in the present, but it was some crime that happened in the past. And essentially that's what I do with my mystery series, my Masarai mystery series. So this is set in like 1999. So, okay, you want to have a microcosm of the community. So, of course, they're sitting around a poker table. And I'll just describe a few characters. You'll probably figure out Tug, but there's a character named Wishbone Tanaka, which is an owner of a dying lawnmower shop. And there's also a character named Yuki. He doesn't say too much, but he's a young journalist from Japan. And then there's a character called Ricky, who, like Moss, was a Kibe Nise, who was in Hiroshima at the time of the bomb. And he is Moss's nemesis. So they were in the middle of their next hand where Tug excused himself to go to the restroom. When he had left the table, Wishbone leaned over towards Moss. "So why the hell you bring Mr. Straight over here, Moss? What you talking about? That guy Yamada writes checks, doesn't drink. Betcha he's one of those religious types, huh?" Moss remembered the Yamada's affiliation with the Sunrise Baptist Church. "That don't mean nothing. That kind of guy can really put a damper on things." Wishbone's pockmarked face was red. Even the tips of his pointy ears were fleshed. "He the type to get us in trouble," Ricky added. "How do we know he's not calling police right now?" "He's not doing that," Moss said without conviction. Ricky cut the deck with one hand, deck of cards with one hand. "He's Inu, I betcha. Inu, dog, snitch. The lowest thing one man could call another." "He's a go-for-broke guy," Wishbone said. "If he figures out who I am, probably knock my head off. Or maybe I should knock his first." Yuki was scribbling in his notebook again. "What's go-for-broke? Army man. That's their motto. You know, go for broke." Wishbone seemed wary of having to explain everything to Yuki. Moss felt his chest tighten. "What you have against him?" "I'm no boy. My brother's a draft resister. We on the other sides of the line from guys like him." "Don't know what you're talking about," said Moss. "My brother went to Leavenworth, okay? The federal penitentiary for not fighting." Moss remained quiet. The Nise who were in California during the war all seemed to be thrown into some kind of jail, whether they were trying to prove a point or minding their own business. "Never heard of it, I betcha." "Yeah, just lately, the young people are making a big deal about it. My boy's a hero, my brother's a hero to them, and rightly so. Nobody else had the guts to say no to the government. Instead, those others were patsies, sacrificing their lives for what? They say yes, yes to the loyalty oath. Yes, they were willing to serve in combat. Yes, they wouldn't bow down to the emperor like any of us would." Wishbone's bloodshot eyes grew large and still. "So I checked no, What the hell? They're going to keep me behind barbed wire. I wasn't going to promise anything. My brother did one better. He said he would serve if we were restored our constitutional rights. So they were sent to hard time prison, 18 months. I had to go to Tule Lake. We all were the black sheep of the community. So the U.S. government imprisoned your brother for not fighting? Yuki seemed confused by Wishbone's personal history lesson. It was confusing. First, the Nisei were placed in camps because they lived near the Pacific Ocean. Then they were put in jail if they didn't agree to fight on behalf of the government that had put them in camps in the first place. Didn't make much sense. Moss had to agree. Yes, yes, Wishbone said impatiently. But my brother would have killed you, son of a guns, back in Japan if we were left free. Moss tried to shield the boy from Wishbone's wholesale anger toward the Japanese and American wartime leaders. That's 50 years ago. So what? Moss, you weren't over here. You don't understand, said Wishbone. Your friend and his people were the ones making a big deal about being veterans, making monuments. They're the ones talking bad about us even now, all running scared about dying. Tug's not like that. He minds his own business. Thinks more about fixing toilets and doorbells than anything else, thought Moss. That's what you think. Wishbone picked his teeth with the fold of a matchbook cover, while Lewis had his own stories of being kidnapped in Peru by the U.S. government to be used as a pawn in a possible prisoner of war exchange. Yuki was scribbling even more furiously in his notebook. Soon he'd had enough for a full-out book. Moss traced his front dental plate with his tongue and then noticed Ricky staring right at him. He hadn't said much during the past few minutes, and Moss took that as a bad sign. When Ricky wasn't talking, it meant he was thinking, and Moss knew that that didn't lead to anywhere good. So that's a portion. The thing that's great about Moss as a mystery character is he was in Japan during World War II. So he's not on any side, you know. He's learned, this is all new to him. And even though Japanese Americans view him as an insider, he's kind of an outsider. So I think he, as well as the narrator, kind of helped to interpret things to the reader. And many readers might be very new to this material, so... Okay, now I'm going to read to you a noir short story called The Chirashi Covenant. And this short story takes place in 1951. And it starts off with a reunion of beauty queens, of Nisei beauty queens. They were all on a court in L.A. in 1941. And a lot of things have happened since the past decade. So this short story is looking at a woman named Helen Mira, who was the first princess, and she is a rebel. She's a total rebel. She's from Terminal Island. She never, you know, she always wanted something more out of her life, and she doesn't like the racial covenants that she has to deal with in 1951. And she wants to live by the ocean. And her husband has instead bought a house in a place called Gardena, California, where a lot of other Japanese Americans live, and she's not happy about that. And she also gets involved in an extramarital affair with a white man, a white real estate agent. Meanwhile, you know, I'm ruining the story for you. I'm going to tell you. her husband dies, and falls off a cliff, and she suspects that the real estate agent is the one who pushed her husband, Frank. So in this section, I'm going to read you the end. And she has her own way of dealing with this, okay? Helen's parents had an old family friend, Kaji-san. I actually named this guy after Bruce Kaji. But I'm sure he would not want to be associated with this short story. But anyway, Kaji-san. Kaji-san, a Japanese immigrant like Helen's father, had been a fisherman as well. He was rambo, rough. A lot of Terminal Islanders had been that way, cured in the sun and salt water. But Kaji-san not only had calloused hands, but a calloused face, dried up crevices like earthquake faults. After the war, Helen's relatives had taken the old bachelor for a while before he got back on his feet and opened a Japanese restaurant in Little Tokyo. To everyone's surprise, Kaji-san succeeded, and before long he had even purchased a boat that was docked at Pier Point Landing in Long Beach. Kaji-san felt indebted to Helen's family, so much so that they even stopped going to his restaurant because he never took their money. But Helen needed a favor now, and Kaji-san was, of course, more than willing to comply. Deep down inside, he had questions and concerns. Helen had lost weight, some weight. She was thin to begin with, but now her high cheekbones were even more prominent and defined. Frank's death had definitely taken a toll on her, but Kaji-san knew that Helen would never do anything rash. She wasn't that type of woman. Helen arrived at the empty restaurant 3 hours before her appointment, a letter self in the back with Kaji-san's key. She needed the extra time to get ready. Bob came early too, 15 minutes early. Helen could tell from the flush in his cheeks that he was excited. She even let him give her a peck on her cheek. That much she could tolerate. Helen had him sit at the wooden counter and served him a piping hot cup of green tea. "I've never had green tea before." He sipped carefully and then grimaced, bitter. "You'll get used to it. This tea is expensive. You'll insult us if you don't finish it." By the time the teacup was empty, Bob's head rested on the wooden counter. Helen went to the kitchen and put on her rubber gloves, then rolled out the wheelbarrow. One time she had been out on the fishing boat when her father had caught a bluefin tuna. It had been a magnificent fish, almost 6 feet tall, almost 300 pounds. It took three men to handle the fish. The fish first needed to be stunned. Helen's father used one of her brother's baseball bats. This time, Helen used Frank's. The fisherman found the soft pot in the fish spot in the fish's head and then pushed a spike in its brain. Helen was amazed how easy it was to kill a huge fish like that. It shuddered as if it was hoping for another chance for life and then became limp. There was a method to cutting a bluefin tuna. You first needed some time to bleed the fish so that its sheen would still be maintained, and then go right to the internal organs in the gilling and gutting of the fish. Later, you would cut the fish's meat into chunks and sell them by the pound. Helen could skip many of the steps she learned as a child. The most important tools here were the knife and the mallet. She was thankful some family friends had watched over her father's tools while they had been in Manzanar. After Helen was done, she carefully packed different parts of Bob in three different suitcases and cleaned the cement floor of Kaji-san's kitchen. She had brought extra bottles of bleach for the task. She then drove to Pier Point Landing and took Kaji-san's motorized fishing boat as far as she could and dropped each suitcase into different parts of the ocean. The water was black as the ink of an octopus, and for a moment, Helen imagined a huge sea monster emerging from the darkness and tearing her, too, into shreds. But her mind was only playing tricks on her. After closing her eyes hard and reopening them, she found that her fear had disappeared. Shortly thereafter, Helen, Diana, and Mama moved into the wood-framed house in Southern Gardena. Next door was a flower farm and packing shed. "That Miura widow is a cold one," the flower grower's wife said to her husband as they were bunching up flowers at night to get ready for the 2 o'clock morning drive to the flower market in Los Angeles. The flower grower Tad just nodded so that his wife would be under the impression that he was listening. "Never says hello. She was on one of those beauty queen courts back in 1941, but she wasn't the queen. Too stuck up for the judges, I think." Tad grunted. He wasn't the one to spread stories, but he knew who she was. One day when he was driving back from the flower market in the morning after the children went to school, he saw her in the middle of his snapdragon blooms next to one of the oil derricks. She was screaming and crying. At first, he thought that she had been injured. When he slowed his panel truck, she straightened her hair and rubbed the smeared makeup from below her eyes. "You okay?" he asked from his open car window. She stared back at him, her eyes shiny like wet black stones. Then she spoke, her voice barely audible above the rhythmic squeak of the derricks. "Are any of us?" Tad's panel truck remained idling as the widow slowly walked back into her house and closed the door. So that's the end of this. So in terms of poetic license, I don't know how many Nisei beauty queens you know who would chop up their former lovers. So I took a lot of them. We could discuss that. So, thank you.
I was thinking of that song right now, "Here We Sit Like Birds in the Wilderness." The three of us here have apparently written about a common theme without having ever met and having this happening that we happen to be here. And so it seems that there is something common going on. This event in Japan in 1945, when the atom bombs dropped, was something that seized all of us, and we wrote about it, each in our different way. And I didn't know that. In fact, I didn't know anything at all about what poetic license really means, and I still don't know. And I wondered why it was chosen. And so maybe Stephen can tell us. But I imagine that it means something about people who want to know what's true and what really happened. And I think the problem is that reality is Rashomon. And everybody's truth is different. Everybody's story is different, and there is no official story. But here we are, people of Japanese ancestry or especially interested in that for some reason, and we're here, and we're seeking some truth from the people that write about our stories and who write from their own experience about what those stories are. When I started to write, well, I think I've been a writer all my life. I think I was born to it. But when I first started to publish was in 1964. And I don't know where that impulse comes from, that longing to communicate, I think. And there was a time in which I just worked and worked at the craft of writing. But in 1964, that changed. I wasn't living to write anymore. I was writing to know life because my life had imploded. I couldn't make sense of the deepest things that I knew within myself. There I was, a young mother with a husband and two children, and I thought that my main reason for living was to do what was right. And what was right, as far as I understood, was to love my husband and my family. And that was it. And if I couldn't do that, there was no sense. And so I had a little crisis. What was the truth? What was I for? Why was I living? If I was there to write, okay. If I was there to be a mother, okay. If I was there to love, how come I couldn't do that? That's the most important thing, as far as I knew, about what it was to be human and to be alive. Why could I not love my husband? And this came in, this kind of problem came to me as a spiritual problem. The problem was, as I understood it, that there was good and there was evil. And the problem of evil just didn't fit in my head. I couldn't make sense of that. So there was this crisis, this emotional, spiritual crisis in my life. And I had to go beneath everything that I'd been taught in order to find out what was true. So I went into the world of dreams, thinking that I might find more truth there than the things that I had been taught. And the world of dreams came up for me as poetry. All the images made sense as poems. And so I wrote poems for the longest time. And so the first thing that I published was a poem. And then, here's what happened. I have in my hand a stone that I carry around with me. And there is a word on that stone. And it reminds me of what happened in 1964. I got to the point where I was doing things in my life that didn't make sense because I just wanted to get to the core issue of why I could not love. And in the midst of the particular elements of that particular crisis, which I won't go into, I came to one startling moment when I thought, okay, is there anything that I can believe in? And what I believed at the time, the words I used at the time are not the words that I would use today, but the words I used at the time was I could believe, the words at the time was that God was good. I could believe that. The way I put it now is I can believe that goodness is and goodness wins and that we have access to it. And so anyway, I kept on writing, but my pen was now different. It wasn't that I was trying to hone my skills or write my stories or do that kind of thing. I mean, the first short story I wrote was not about Japanese Canadians at all. It was about a white family called the Parkers, and it was about males, because that's all I ever read. And it turned out, though, that in fact it was a Japanese Canadian story, because it was a story about a child that had been in the mountains of BC, which is where we were interned, and then had been sent to the prairies where the child lived and hated it, which is my story, which is a Japanese Canadian story. But I didn't think of it as a Japanese Canadian story. I just thought of it as a story. I mean, so all this during this time when I was writing these things, I mean, that was poetic license in as much as I was writing, but I wasn't writing about, as far as I knew, about Japanese Canadians, although I was. And since that time, I have just been listening to whatever voice it is that tells me to write whatever it is that I write, and I just write. And I never knew all the time that I was writing, that I was, for most of those years, that I was writing anything except something that was being urgent to do. And so when I wrote Oba San, I didn't know whether it would ever be published. Nobody was interested in stories about anybody except white people. And those were all the publishers. And so the book kept getting rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected I don't know how many times. And the first, I mean, McClellan Stewart was the big publisher at the time, and they had wanted to have a book. They said, well, if you're writing this thing, are you writing a novel or are you writing about Japanese Canadians? Write about Japanese Canadians and use this material as a mine and just do that. But anyway, I didn't want to do that, so I kept writing it until finally somebody did accept it, and so there it is. As the first novel that I wrote. Anyway, where am I going with all this? Oh, yeah, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, the atom bomb. I wrote the book, and I didn't know there was a mystery all the way through it. There was a mother, and she disappeared, and nobody knew what happened to her. I didn't know either. So I gave it to the publisher, and they said, "What happened to the mother?" And I said, well, I don't know. She disappeared. Isn't life like that? Don't people disappear? Isn't that good enough? And the editor said, the reader has to know. So I thought, okay, here's poetic license. I didn't know what happened to her. I don't know where the idea came that she was in Nagasaki came. I don't know where that idea came from. But I stuck it in the book. And I didn't have any background. I didn't know anything at all about Nagasaki except a bomb had fallen on it. I knew nothing. And so there was one reviewer who said, the book is fine. It's even perfect except for the fact that she put in this thing about Nagasaki. It doesn't belong in this book. It's about Japanese Canadians. However, there it was in the book. So all these years later, it's really interesting how fiction follows fact, follows fiction, follows fact. It all gets wound around together in this one big, interesting mess of imagination and reality. What happened was, I'm writing a book right now called Gently to Nagasaki, because I'm only now beginning to understand why that the book begins and ends really with Nagasaki, because it begins on August the 9th, which is when the bomb fell. And that's the first thing in the book, is that. And it ends on August the 9th. It ends with Nagasaki having been the place where the mother died, or mother was, she didn't die then and there, but she was there. So in Gently to Nagasaki right now, I had initially thought of it as a trilogy, and there would be Obasan and then Itsuka and then this other book. But this is a totally different thing. And I am learning so much as I go in this book that I just can't tell you. Anyway, one interesting thing that happened when I happened to be in Los Angeles, the second time I'd been there, I was at the Japanese American National Museum conference thing that was going on there. And during a break in the day, I went for a walk and I went through Japantown, or that little bit of Japantown. And as I was walking out of there, a voice said, "It's you!" So I turned and I looked up. And there is, I don't know if you know the street musician called Arthur Nakane. Do you know him?
Yes, the one-man band.
Yeah, the one-man band. He's been on America's Got Talent and so on. He's a great guy. Well, there he was. He said, "It's you." And he came out and he gave me a big hug and he said, "I'll never let you go again." And Asao Nakane is how I knew him. His name is Arthur. But I knew him in Vancouver when he was a young man, when he was about 20 years old. And I was about 21. I was married and so on. And I got to know him a little bit. He's, anyway, the thing was that when I was writing Obasan, I was thinking I should use a name. I thought, why not Nakane? Why not? It could be Nakano. It could be anything. It could be anything under the sun. But I used Asao's last name in the book. He didn't know that. He didn't know until he finally read the book after meeting me again. I sent it to him, so he said, "Asao Nakane." And he said, you know, I thought it's a very common name. But he said, no, he's only met one other person in Japan who has that name. So it was not a common name. Now, here's the interesting thing about Asao Nakane and our correspondence after this fact, is he's got a brother called Stephen Nakane, who is the brother of Naomi Nakane in the book. There is a Naomi. Here's a Naomi. There was a Naomi. I don't know where that name came from either. But the person who tells the story in the book is Naomi Nakane, and her brother is Stephen. Now, Asao has a real-life brother named Stephen, who was also the person who introduced him into being a musician. And it turns out that I have to go back into Gently to Nagasaki a bit to tell you what's important for me in the story Gently to Nagasaki. I don't know, it might lose you a bit because I'm just jumping in with this. But in Nagasaki, the way that bomb fell, where it fell, and on whom it fell, that is such an extraordinary story. It's such a strange story. It was not, that bomb was not meant to fall on Nagasaki. It was intended to go to Kokura. And it missed, so many things happened on that day that plane took off from Tinian Island with that bomb on board. And it didn't fall on Kokura. It was supposed to fall on Tokiwa Bridge in Nagasaki. It didn't go there because there was cloud covering and they were ordered to drop the bomb only when they could see their target. So it kept on going and it dropped right on the preeminent spot of Christianity in all of East Asia, right two blocks away from Urakami Cathedral, which could host 5,000 people. And that's where it fell. And it fell right on top of the people, the very special, special people in Japan called the hidden Christians, who had survived hundreds of years of persecution and had finally returned to that spot. And that is where the bomb fell, right on the best friends of the Christian West. It wiped them out. After all those years, hadn't been able to. So what does that mean to me? Gently to Nagasaki is about this statement, love your enemy. But this statement, which was a proscription, in my view, was transformed on that moment to a description. We cannot love our enemies. All we have to know is to know that we already do love them. We just don't know who they are. We think they're our enemies. We will bomb them. We will harm them. But they are our best friends. This is what happened. The best friends of the West were killed by that last atom bomb. So the journey of Gente to Nagasaki is to discover how this is true. And the thing is that Asao told me that his parents, his mother, was a Christian who had been at Nagasaki and had studied there. And Asao's father had been part of the, his ancestry had been part of the samurai clan that went to quell the rebellion at Shimabara, which is right close by. And so there they were, his mother and his father, gently at Nagasaki, united in marriage. If I had had that background, I could have put all of that into Oba-san, and it would have all made sense, and it would have told the whole story of Oba-san, which I'm only now finding out to be the story, which was fact, and I had been toying around with the fiction of it, but didn't know. So what I say about poetic license is, let it go, because it's all around us. And what I believe is that the universe is there, more wonderful than we can imagine it ever was. And all the things that we measure here and call facts are nothing compared to what the universe is doing with us and with our lives. And so these years in my old age, as I'm now 78 years old, are the best years of my life because I have in my hand this stone. And the word on the stone is trust. I trust the universe. This universe that we are in has just a little bit more matter than it has antimatter, which is why we are here. We know that when matter and antimatter collide, they create light. And here we are in this world, which is full of darkness and full of evil and full of the unknown. But what I posit with my poetic license is another universe which is filled with light, with which we are connected when we trust it. And I trust it, and I will trust it to the end. And it informs my work, and it informs my life, and our connections with one another, and we are all deeply connected.
Far be it from me to put in a word now. actually, I first had the pleasure of meeting and working with Joyce back at Washington State University in the mid-1980s when we invited you to come talk to the students and to read. And what you said then really intrigued me. You said that, in a way, Oba-san wrote itself for you, because you were a researcher in the Canadian archives in Ottawa.
Because of a dream.
Because of a dream. And you went down one of the aisles there, and it was as if the papers fell into your hands. The papers of Muriel Kitagawa, right?
Yeah.
It was a story of an Aunt Emily, shall we say, but it was a story of an activist, Japanese-Canadian activist, who just had to get some kind of redress for what had happened in Japanese-Canadian history, not only during the war, but before and after, certainly. And the way you talked struck me as being the way the epic poets have always said, sing through me, muse. It's the muse who sings through me. And that is the universe. It was singing through you. I thought I was fascinated by that. I said, yeah, sure, but you had to write it. I mean, this is a lot of work, you know, but your experience was that a muse, in a sense, was singing through you. And in a way, hearing you now, it's a repetition of that. The title Poetic License, you notice, has a question mark next to it, which means, you know, when we hear a presentation like the three that we heard today, we might say, well, maybe the poetic part, the fictive part of our storytelling and our self-expression is closer to the truth, not fact necessarily, but to truth than, let's say, a strict, you know, an attempt to stick strictly to historical fact. The facts by themselves do not tell the story. But on the other hand, when we have stories that, follow, you might say, the conventional and expected pattern with a beginning and a middle and an end, then we have to recognize that that too is like putting a form or shape on the random, possibly, the Rashomon universe, so that we're like making a story out of what is just a random universe, very possibly so. Anyway, now it's interesting about at least two of these authors here. One of the members of our audience, Tamiko, you wrote a review for International Examiner, you know, of Anshu, right? And it was puzzling, you know, like this book does not come to an end. I mean, Himiko suffers the atomic bomb, and she has to go on with her life. She lives. Her baby, which is why she was sent to Japan in the first place, unwed mother, dies in her arms. But she has to live on. And so it's as if there is no redeeming joy. But on the other hand, there is truth there, some kind of a very deep and profound truth. And that reminds me, for the sake of our panel here, Joy, didn't a Canadian reviewer review Obasan and title the review Joyless Joy? Right? Yeah, same story. The two of you like this. Anyway, let's open this up for a discussion with the audience. And what happened to... Yeah, I'll take the mic out there for anybody to use. We have 10 minutes left. You have to speak into the mic because all of this is being audio recorded, but only through the microphones. So if anybody wants to say something, please go to the microphone or raise your hand and I'll take the mic to you. Dr. Tamiko Nomura.
Thank you so much to all three of you. I have had the pleasure of reading all three of your works, and I feel like I've been in conversation with your works for a very long time, and I'm a writer now myself. So thank you for all of that you've given us. I wanted to ask a little bit just about, because of what the title said to me, I'm one of Steve's students, by the way. So what the title said to me was, to what extent do you feel a particular accountability to historical facts, how and the research that you do, and a particular living community that is still here with us? Have you had people say, oh, but, you know, I read that in your book, and it's not quite right, or I guess my question really is, what has been the response then for people whose history it is that that you've worked with? Thank you.
Well, I write nonfiction, too. So I feel that as a nonfiction writer, I have a responsibility to be as accurate, to search out those documents, to verify oral history against those documents. But I do think fiction is different. I do think if I want to purely write about history, I should be doing it in nonfiction. That's my belief. I think that's it's a beautiful way to document our history. I think with with fiction, I mean, well, for me, myself, I won't speak for anyone else. I'm trying to write stories. And I think there's the hardest part is your main characters or your characters being authentic and real. And I don't mean it just ethnically. I mean, like, look at her. How would you describe yourself? Are you just of Japanese ancestry? Are you just a woman? Are you, you know, we're many, many things. And I think as writers, I feel that I'm striving to get that authentic character. And some of it, you know, there's this word like info dump. Like sometimes if you're writing historical fiction or things that there's a section in the book, okay, we are going to educate you and here's, you know. And I think as fiction writers, it should be, you shouldn't be able to see that, you know. What I read was a little bit of that, but there's a, you know, Tug, the Go for Broke guy and Wishbone, there's going to be a conflict between those two. So I felt that it was important for the readers to kind of understand that back history, like what was going on in Wishbone's mind when that happened. But I don't know. It's so, Sherman Alexie, who's from this area, I heard him speak after 9/11. And before, because there's a lot of mysteries that are, like Tony Hillerman writes a Navajo-based mystery. And some Native Americans were very, you know, it's like, he's a white guy writing about us, you know, and they would dismiss it. But Sherman Alexie said after 9/11, he became less tribal, you know, and said he didn't want to be so fundamentalist and be more open. You know, Tony Hillerman's, you know, maybe some parts he gets wrong, but he's really striving. He really strove to get things right. I think he's that Sherman Alexie still calls that colonial literature. But I have become more open through my genre because there's a lot of people outside of our community who write about us. And heck, if you get it right, you know, or if you're doing your homework and attempting, you know, I'm cool with that. The biggest thing I want is like people of color to write our. Let's get our voices in there. It's okay if outside voices come in, but let's get ours, you know. And I have some hand. We're having a short story context with the Little Tokyo Historical Society. So the winner gets $1,000. So come and get some flyers from me. But that's the main thing that my soapbox. Like let's all of us write stories.
Oh, okay. When you're writing stories, I think you're trying to get at some emotional truth, and you write a lot of scenes. And I guess as a young child, my father always used to say, "Oh, you are L-I-E." I used to lie a lot, so I lie a lot. Anshu, I didn't know. I mean, I was born in 1943, so I didn't know much about the war. I used my husband's library to, you know, learn a lot of the about Japan, and so it's the timeline. I tried to keep as much, you know, the historical timeline. I had to keep, but other than that, it's all things I've made up or read about or, you know, mixed things. So it's all, as they say, L-I-E.
I want to add, I think sometimes the thing I get concerned about is like Asian American characters being fully fleshed out, because for so long I would read about these really stoic, like Japanese men. And yeah, you know, they don't talk a whole lot of a certain age, and I always say that we can't have a Japanese-American sitcom because it'd be kind of quiet around the dinner table. However, that said, we have a lot of humor, right? Like, when I was at the Ralph Shimpo's, like, I would read the obituaries, you know, Nisei woman, Porky, you know. I mean, these crazy nicknames, and that's what, you know, you got to have a sense of humor to, like, name yourself that or go by that name. And so what I strive on some in the Moss series is to have humor in there. So I think there's other parts of our, it's not only born, you know, here and went to Manzanar, da-da-da-da-da. It's also the human characteristics, I think, that I strive to pull out.
Yeah. These are kind of a bit more practical questions, but those who write about, say, during the war in Japan or even other era, how do you do the research if you feel that is necessary? In other words, I think this issue of truth versus fact is a crucial matter, and I do agree that fiction or any literature aims to tell the truth, and the truth is different from the fact. But if you want to write and sort of to reach some truth, and you want to have a backup with the fact, in your experience, how did you go about researching? And if I add one more question, and if to do those research is not easy, in other words, unless you can read tons of books written in Japanese or written by those who lived there, the history, how do you feel about writing about, say, Nagasaki in Hiroshima when you were not there or you haven't learned through from those who lived through that? And furthermore, when your resource is limited, because I kind of think that your resource, if you are here, is not tremendous amount. So I was just wondering, how do you go about doing the research if you find that that's necessary? And this, I got the question because when I heard Candy, this is in during the toward the end of the war or after the war, which I lived through, and I do know that there was no candy available wherever. So I just wanted to have some idea of how do you go about doing the research.
As for me, I was lucky. I had a U.S. Japan fellowship, and I went to Japan and lived there for 6 months, which I did a lot of research. And I did the best I could in trying to retrieve a lot of the information. And you know, there's areas that I probably missed, and there are areas that are not true to what somebody might call fact. So, but I tried to be as truthful as I could. The candy was in 1943 when they were, you know, practically starving. Ame? About the candy? You know, I looked at things at what they had in rations and things like that, but, you know, I may have missed something. I'm not sure. So that's an interesting point. It's like I wrote in the beginning of Anshu about machetes, and somebody said, there were no machetes. We didn't call them machetes in Hilo. It was cane knives. So, you know, there are little... It's inevitable, I think, but I'm trying to show in the bigger picture how it was, how bad it was, perhaps.
Yeah, it starts in Tokyo. Yeah.
Different people had different experiences, too, and, you know, so I can't really say. Okay.
I don't think that there are any sessions of for the next 2 hours, but I think we need to end anyway. We do have a timekeeper in the room. I got one for Naomi. Are there bluefin tuna in the Eastern Pacific?
That I don't. You know what's funny?
Atlantic or around Japan, I think, Western Pacific. I don't know. You're talking to fishermen from Hawaii.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
I think.
And then, okay, for the last bit that I'm going to say about humor, which was mentioned a little while ago, too. Yeah, the humor, of course, can be very deep and sardonic. What Juliet and I did not say was that April 1st, 1946, tsunami, and the poem she read about the boy going out to gather fish at the bare sea bottom when the ocean receded, and he sees at the end the wave curling over him. Of course, that's all her imagination because that boy perished. Lapa hoi hoi. At that spit of land way down at the bottom of the cliff, in other words, ashore, the joke we have in Hawaii, or the myth, is that the kids ran out to the dry seafloor. They said, look at all the fish. And their teachers at the school that was located there said, come back in. It's a tsunami. A tsunami is coming. And the kids said, April Fool. And they all died. So we end the session. Thanks very much for coming. Oh, I'm supposed to say at the very beginning, I'm Steve Sumida. I'm from the University of Washington.